What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Welcome to the Katie Helper Show. We are so excited to be here with you. We have another great show for you. I got to start saying stuff besides that, but every show is great if I do say so myself. And I'm not praising myself. I'm praising the amazing guests and the amazing team working on the Katie Helper Show. And that includes Brad Bloom, Tyler. I don't know if I'm allowed to say his last name, so I'll check with that next week. Phantom Osfanto and Nate, who does research. Newborn. So thanks to all the team. Also, thanks to everyone watching. Thanks for everyone who likes the stream. That's a really easy way to support the show. Just give it a thumbs up. Also, if you can, please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. And this week's Patreon is amazing. It's a preview of an interview. It's kind of excerpts of an interview that we did in London with none other than Jeremy Corbyn. And so Patreon people will get that. If you are a $5 a month member, then you get that. If you can't afford that, but you can hopefully maybe afford $12 a year and you donate $1 a month, you get to know that you're making the show happen because we literally couldn't do the show without your support. Also, subscribe, hit subscribe, then hit the bell. And I'm going to bring on the first of our two guests. Now, this is a very exciting show because last week we spoke with human rights lawyer and former UN official Craig McIver, and we only got to talk to him about one of his articles, an article about how the media could be held liable and could be prosecuted for its role in genocide, legally responsible for its role in genocide. We didn't get to talk as much about his other piece that he'd written at Mondo Weiss about why Israel does not have the right to defend itself. And as we promised last week, we said we'd bring Craig back on the show, and we're doing it this week. But before that, we have a very special guest. I'm so excited she's here because usually she's in another country in a different time zone, and it's very hard to have her on. She's usually in Beirut. She's here in the States, though, because she has stuff to do here. And we're taking advantage of that by doing a live show, which people, unfortunately, it's sold out. But if you got tickets already, please do remember to show up to the show because you got tickets, and make sure you show up or else there'll be people who can't come and it'll be very sad because of you. So that's at the People's Forum Thursday at 7 p.m. And it'll be me, Rania Kallik, and Abby Martin. Okay, so I'm going to bring on Rania Kallik. And who is Rania Kallik, you asked? Rania Kallik is a Beirut-based journalist. She is with Breakthrough News and hosts their show over there, which is called Dispatches. And she also hosts the weekly Freedom Side live stream with other friend of show, Eugene Puryear. So Rania, welcome.
Hey, Katie. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Thanks for joining.
I'm pissed.
Yeah. Tell us why you're pissed. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. So like you said, I usually am in Lebanon. That's where I live. That is, you know, I'm a hyphenated person. I'm Lebanese American. And today, as I'm sure many of your viewers know, the Israelis launched what can only be described as a countrywide act of terrorism against the Lebanese people. They booby-trapped a bunch of pagers that Hezbollah had distributed to its members with an explosive, and today decided to trigger those explosives across the country around 3:30 p.m. when people were out and about, you know, grocery shopping. Some people were sitting at home with their kids. Some were, you know, I have to remind people, I know Hezbollah is classified as a terrorist organization by the U.S., That's just what the US and Israel think, by the way. A lot of the rest of the world doesn't necessarily see Hezbollah that way, but Hezbollah is also a political party. They are they have been elected to government in Lebanon. They're part of the biggest political bloc in the country. Therefore, they have a political branch, meaning they have members of parliament. So several members of parliament, one of them actually, Ali Ammar, the son was killed in this attack by an exploding pager. Another one, Hassan Fadlallah, two of his sons were injured. One of his sons was injured so badly he's in surgery. Another one was Fit Safa. He's a pretty high-level Hezbollah official in the political branch. Two of his sons were injured. So the point is that these are political figures. These aren't necessarily, you know, soldiers. And yes, some of these people may have been soldiers, but they were far from any battlefield. This was such a dirty way to attack people. And it was essentially an attack on civilians because you turned human beings into bombs. This injured at least like 3,000 people and something like 200 are in critical condition. And according to a recent New York Times article that I was looking through before I came on, the Israelis rigged the pagers to beep before they exploded, meaning people like took them out of their pockets if they had time to look at them. So this is something that exploded in people's faces. It killed at least one child, a 10-year-old girl. It's completely disgusting that something like this happened. And it's also even more disgusting the way it's been covered in the media. You see really ridiculous headlines and then really ridiculous framing that this was some sort of attack on Hezbollah. No, this was an attack on the country of Lebanon. And you can imagine the kind of coverage and framing it would receive had Hezbollah or Hamas, or let's say a country, an adversary country like Iran or China or Russia, had rigged the cell phones or whatever devices of American officials to just explode across the country while they're out running errands. I mean, it's completely ridiculous.
Like American officials or members of the military, like anyone would be okay with that.
Or even members of Congress, because I want to remind you, like these pagers are distributed to members of Hezbollah. Members of Hezbollah can mean a lot of things. It can also mean people who work in civil institutions. In Lebanon, every major political party has institutions that they run. They run hospitals, they run clinics, they run schools. That applies to Hezbollah. So you're talking about explosive devices going off in schools, in grocery stores, in hospitals. Like, this is completely unacceptable. And anybody who's trying to legitimize this, including the smirking evil spokesperson of the U.S. State Department, Matt Miller, calling them legitimate targets, you're the actual terrorists. Like, this is an act of terrorism.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Rania, because we actually have a clip of Matt Miller, and trigger warning everyone, because he is a smirking demon, as you just described him. Well, you called him smirking. Demon is my term.
I said evil, but demon works.
Evil, yeah. Yeah, either way. Yeah. Here is Matt Miller of the State Department responding to the bombing of pagers that happened. So let's take a look.
The Lebanon? Sure. Well, just to begin with, in general, what does the U.S. know about what happened? There have been a series of deaths and injuries, apparently, from exploding pagers. Was the U.S., the U.S. have any knowledge? What does it know now, and when did it know about what has happened?
So we are gathering information on this incident. I can tell you that the U.S. was not involved in it. The U.S. was not aware of this incident in advance, and at this point, we're gathering information.
And what information have you gathered so far?
We'll continue to collect information. I don't have any public readout to give now, but we're collecting information in the same way that journalists are across the world to gather the facts about what might have happened.
Obviously, it doesn't take much guesswork who the most likely culprit would be in terms of doing this, in terms of who the enemy of Hezbollah is. Do you have any indications that to doubt that it would be Israel that was behind the...
I don't have any assessment to offer one way or other at this point.
And I know you're saying that, but in terms of what this means, I mean, there's been for a number of weeks the talk of dialing down, or at least not having a retaliation from Iran over, you know, sort of a tit for tat, if you will. How does this play into it? Is there any message that you're sending to Israel in terms of what to do next, and, or for that matter, to Iran, to Hezbollah, in terms of how to respond to this?
So I never want to either comment or speculate about the impact of any one incident, especially in the early stages of an incident. And I'm not going to do so here. That's been our consistent policy to try and avoid doing. I will say that our overall policy remains consistent, which is we do want to see a diplomatic resolution to the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. We want to see one that allows the tens of thousands of Israelis who've been displaced from their homes and the tens of thousands of Lebanese who have been displaced from their homes to be able to return home. And that's what we are continuing to pursue.
So disingenuous. But also, he's doing what he has to do, which is lie. I mean, he's a professional liar. Look, yesterday, 24 hours before this attack, you had the Americans telling the Israelis, warning the Israelis with their scary, scary words, not to escalate with Lebanon, because the Israelis have now added the Northern Front and returning their people to the Northern Front or to the North as part of one of their goals for this broader war they're conducting. Or genocide they're conducting in Gaza. And so this is a slap in the face. I mean, to trigger these devices the day after the Americans warn them yet again not to escalate with Lebanon is to basically say, F you, America. And to also say, we're going to escalate. You know, Netanyahu is in this kind of tug of war with Yoav Gallant right now about how to deal with Gaza, with Lebanon. And so this could escalate into a bigger war depending on what Israel decides to do, because clearly the Americans have no ability, nor do they care, to really stop it. If they wanted to stop Israel from committing genocide in Gaza, they could. If they wanted to stop Israel, and they have a couple times stopped Israel from carrying out a larger scale war in Lebanon, which the Americans are more worried about, because a genocide in Gaza can stay contained to Gaza as far as the Americans see it. But once you start to go to a bigger war in Lebanon, it might, you know, drag in regional players that would drag in the Americans, and the Americans don't want that. So all that said, I mean, nothing the Americans say matters, because they're just not willing to materially restrict Israel in any significant way. So here we are once again on the precipice of potentially a larger scale war. All I can do is sit here and speculate. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, in one way you could say that, you know, it's suggested that these pagers that Israel exploded, they were Taiwanese made, and they were apparently held up for some period of time. The Israelis were able to intervene and obviously booby trapped them, but that apparently happened months and months ago. So Israel's been sitting on this as an option against Hezbollah for months and months and months, which means it was pre-planned. But it also means that they chose this moment to do it. So on the one hand, you could surmise that, okay, maybe they decided to do this now because it's all they have. And they've also responded by, you know, trying to send messages that they don't want a bigger war from this. So they don't want a big escalation after they've done this. But on the other hand, this could be a prelude to something bigger. It could be trying to bait Hezbollah into striking back, which, you know, Hezbollah has demonstrated a lot of restraint up until now. They've only hit military targets. They've refrained from striking too deep into Israel. They've kind of played this balancing act of, you know, making sure they hit back so they can reestablish deterrence, but not hit back so hard that it triggers an all-out war. But this situation is not sustainable. Like, this has been going on since October 8th. And at this point, the Lebanon front and the Gaza front, Palestine front, are not connected anymore as far as Israel sees it. So even if there's a ceasefire in Gaza, the Israelis will continue to hit Hezbollah because they, you know, see that as a security threat. They want to return their settlers to the north. And they also don't want to do it in a way that makes them look like they've been defeated. So this is where we are. It's largely because of the Americans and the Israelis. It's because of the Americans and the Israelis. And I'm not sure, you know, how it's going to play out, but it's certainly a dangerous situation we're in. But what I do know is that the Israelis don't know how to do anything without playing dirty and without carrying large acts of terrorism.
Right. This is like undeniably terrorism. And of course, the media is not describing it that way. As you pointed out, Rania, if Israel were at the receiving end of something like this, or the United States were at the receiving end of something like this, there'd be no ambiguity about it. It would be condemned, roundly condemned, by Western political elites and the media as terrorism. But because it's Israel doing it, it's not. Now, I want to show some reactions to this. So let's look at this one tweet. This shows a screenshot of Ron Compias. And Ron Compias is the Washington Bureau Chief of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. And let's take a look at what he had to say about this. So he tweets, "Scrambling to find my BlackBerry shares." That's his response. And Ali Harb quote tweets that and says, "A little girl was killed. Civilians across Lebanon were literally terrorized with pagers exploding in grocery stores, barbershops, and all sorts of urban spaces, injuring countless innocent people. But the crass memification of Israeli terrorism is socially accepted in the U.S. I would say that's a good point. Can you imagine a journalist making a joke about an explosion that killed Israelis?
Oh my God, you're not allowed to say anything that's even remotely like blaming Israel. If you're in the mainstream media, you're not even allowed to like call Palestinians human. You're not even allowed to use the word occupation, let alone celebrate any act of even self-defense, by the way, against Israeli soldiers. Like if somebody in the mainstream media were to celebrate an act of self-defense by a Palestinian against Israeli soldiers, like trying to murder their family, they would be immediately fired. Arabs certainly aren't allowed to celebrate the people they view as resistance fighters across the region. They're completely censored from Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, if they dare do that. Meanwhile, my For You page today has been just a tsunami of Israelis and their supporters making memes out of this, celebrating this, cackling about this. I mean, it's really disgusting. You know, they accuse us of celebrating death and, you know, celebrating murder and celebrating terrorism. I mean, just like every Israeli accusation is a confession, that is, accusation is a confession. They literally celebrate death. We've seen them do it since October 7th, since they've been killing people in Gaza. And I saw a number of Israelis doing it today. I mean, I even got like a bunch of Israelis and their supporters fantasizing about me being killed in one of these explosions. Yeah. Like, it's just, it's sick. They're sick.
Yeah, it is sick. And we actually have a couple of those tweets. This is not a particularly high profile person, but I think it's worth showing. Then we'll get to an actually high profile person. So classical Lib Mott, who has an Israeli flag in his handle. So you tweeted out, Rania, not a pager attack, a terrorist attack. And he quote tweets that and says, surprisingly, Rania was not caught up in this operation today. Anything you want to say to that person, by the way, who was also harassing like low key?
Just, you're sick, dude. Get some help. Like, seriously, get offline and get some help and stop fantasizing about people like me being like blown to bits by Israeli terrorism. Like, get some, seriously, go to therapy.
Yeah.
It's the nicest thing I can say to you.
Yeah. But you, Rania, you celebrate death and they celebrate life.
Yeah, they celebrate life. And I just like all Arabs, I just apparently like I'm infatuated with death and hating and all the things that they actually are.
Right. Projection.
Yeah.
The projection is strong. And now let's take a look at this one clip. And this is from a woman you've had interesting interactions with before. You were on the Piers Morgan show with her. And she is like an Israeli shill, I guess like an Israeli Hasbaris. She's from LA.
Indigenous to the Middle East, all the way from LA.
Indigenous to the Middle East. Yeah, you'll be able to see from the way what she looks like. This is Emily Schrader, who is a journalist at Ynet News. So she responded to your tweet. I guess your tweet was pretty powerful on your part, Rania.
My not pager attack.
not a pager attack, a terrorist attack. They don't like, these people are upset because it's true. If it weren't true what you were saying, they'd ignore it.
Yeah.
So Emily writes, guys, seriously though, can we just have a moment of silence for Hezbollah fangirl Rania? She's having a really bad day because her best friend in Hezbollah had an explosive day, if you know what I mean. And then that's that, like, no one can ever, there's never a good time to use that emoji, by the way, the like laughing so hard you're crying. It's never good. It's never okay.
Not yet.
What's the other one?
It's a pager. It's a pager.
A pager. That's adorable.
Yeah. Laughing pager.
Emily, you represent the best of Israel, the celebration of life, the celebration of explosive pagers that literally kill people, including children. And also people are going to have amputations. I mean, sometimes we lose track of when we hear like wounded. I think lots of times we're relieved. It's like, oh, only this number of people were killed and the rest of them are wounded. Wounded can mean like losing limbs.
Yeah. Or like your face being shattered. I mean, if you were like looking at a beeper.
Yeah.
I mean, look, again, she needs help. Like you need help. Like you are also like, maybe you're a little homicidal because to laugh at that, like, listen, war, even if we're going to call this a war, I'm not happy anyone is dying. Like, this is what really I cannot understand. I cannot ever relate to. I mean, there's a lot of things about Israelis I cannot relate to. And one of them is this like excitement and glee about the horrors they're causing. Because even when Israelis get killed, like, I don't want anyone to die, dude. Like, I don't want anyone to die. I want this all to be over. I want your stupid settler apartheid state. I want your regime to fall so all this violence can end, because it is the source of all this violence. And I'm sick of it. Everyone's sick of it, except apparently for people like her, who think it's hilarious. Like, you're a sick person if you think it's hilarious that a bunch of people were terrorized across the country today with exploding devices, with literally IEDs, like across the country, thousands of them, just exploding at random in random places, literally a terrorist attack. And she's laughing about it. And she's, you know, she's not going to face any consequences for that.
Right. None. Of course not. Yeah.
None.
None. Yeah. And I want to ask you, Rania, as someone who is based in Beirut, what are people that you know there, what are they reporting? What are they feeling, experiencing? What are people saying who you're in touch
with? They're absolutely horrified. This is really scary. I mean, Lebanon's been living kind of on the precipice of war. Well, always lives on the precipice of war, unfortunately. But especially since October 7th, October 8th. And there's been a few really scary moments, but this, you know, it's been sort of contained to certain parts of Lebanon. Not that that makes it okay, but this was just super, like, again, a bunch of explosive devices going off at random in like crowded spaces where just everybody is. It was really scary. The hospitals were packed with people today. Doctors were completely overwhelmed because this was a mass casualty event. People were donating blood as much as possible because there was lots of blood needed. It was really scary. It also, like, you know, people in Lebanon are already traumatized for so many reasons, but I think, you know, the Beirut port blast was one of those other sort of situations that was quite widespread and just like indiscriminate.
You were there for that.
And so people were making comparisons to that. One person said, you know, everybody knows somebody who lost a finger because they do. I mean, it's just horrible. It's absolutely horrific. Tomorrow, there's been like a strike called by Lebanon's main labor union, and schools will be off. And it's just like it's a real, you know, devastating day. I mean, it's devastating. Obviously, this was a blow to Hezbollah in many ways, right? But it was also a blow to the country. This was an attack on an entire country. That's the sentiment and anger. A lot of anger across Lebanon today. And you know what? I would say a lot of politicians who aren't necessarily on the side of Hezbollah came out and expressed their support for those who were injured and martyred, and, you know, their support for also resistance against Israel. So, I mean, it unified the country a little bit, I guess, except for the, you know, typical actors that hate Hezbollah, continue to hate Hezbollah. But the point is, this was really like an unacceptable, horrific moment. And, you know, I'm not sure what's going to come after it, but just a devastating day for Lebanon. And what's really disgusting is if this had happened in any Western capital, it would just be all you hear about in the most disgusting way. And instead, the way it was covered was like, you kind of saw the mainstream media in the US sort of marveling at Israeli ingenuity. So brave. It's so brave to booby trap people's cell phones and pagers. Yeah. So badass. So James Bond. So impressive. That's all they can talk about. That's the way they're framing it. People's lives were destroyed today. People's lives are being destroyed every single day by Israel. Like, it's like we can't keep up with them. But it just keeps spreading. Right. It keeps spreading. And it's just, you know, it leaves people in a space, and I'll include myself among them, of just like, I don't know how much longer this can go on. I don't know how much longer this is sustainable. And I don't know how much more people can take.
Yeah. Well, Rania, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're with family right now because you're not usually based here. And so we especially appreciate your making time for us. And I will see you, on Thursday at the People's Forum. So excited.
Very excited about it.
And everyone should check out Rania's great work.
I was going to give a shout out. Everyone go follow Breakthrough News if you don't already. And also like the show, because, you know, Katie's really good at shouting at our audience to like the show. So I'm just reemphasizing that.
Yeah, true. Oh yeah, like the show. Give it a like. Yeah. Thanks for reminding us. Yeah. Thank you. And Rania, I mean, I always have a great time with you, and we always laugh and use humor. But I also I sending condolences.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Katie.
It's awful.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Rania. See you soon.
Bye, guys.
And we're gonna keep this discussion going because Craig McIver is an excellent source of information and analysis. As someone who is a human rights lawyer and was a UN official, he obviously has a very firm grasp on international law and human rights and the way that things like this violate that. So we're going to bring on back to the show, Craig McIver. Hi, Craig, how are you?
Hi, Katie, I'm okay, thank you.
I wanted to start out by asking you to respond to what just happened.
Well, obviously, another very dark day, and I think our thoughts are all with The people in Lebanon, I've been seeing messages from people who are just, as Rania was pointing out, are living in terror. Everybody's afraid of their telephones. And, you know, it's interesting. I heard her talking about some of these trolls online. I've gotten a few of those as well. All of them implying that I should be careful in using my telephone.
You know, disgusting.
Kind of your next sort of thing. And the celebrations coming from that wing of society are quite disturbing as well. This was a massive terrorist attack on the Lebanese people and the country of Lebanon. Thousands of people, as Rania pointed out, have been hurt. And the Lebanese people are terrorized by it. And I say that's the first thing is that, you know, any place that something like this happened, it would be a historic event because of the scope and the nature of the attack. You know, the degree to which the Western media tries to sanitize this one, I think is going to be very disturbing. I'm not sure they're going to get away with it. I think secondly, it also opens up a very dangerous new front on global terrorism, putting us all at risk. Once again, Israel has found a way to threaten the safety of all of us, because this is another tactic of terrorism that won't stop with Israel doing it to Lebanon. In this case, Israel will likely do it in other places, and others will mimic this approach as well. And so once again, Israel has made us all less safe. It's also a major escalation, possibly could provoke a wider war. We've all been, you know, afraid that ultimately that Israel's provocations in Lebanon and elsewhere could spread more broadly in the region. This is something that Hezbollah will have to respond to, predictably. And we don't know what the next step is going to be or whether this was something preemptive done by Israel in order to prepare its own subsequent attacks. And then the other point that I was making as an international lawyer is that this was a grave breach of international humanitarian law and a gross violation of human rights law. In human rights law, obviously, extrajudicial executions are prohibited. Targeting civilians is prohibited in IHL, and we know not all Hezbollah.
IHL is international human rights international law.
International humanitarian law.
Humanitarian law, okay.
Yeah. And you know, some of these were targeting civilians. Not all Hezbollah personnel are combatants. They are a political party. They're in the government. They run services and so on. And so targeting those individuals is a violation of international humanitarian law just on its face. Also note that the ambassador of Iran was wounded in one of these attacks with all of the implications that come with that. But at the very least, the ambassador of Iran is very clearly a civilian, whatever his relationship to Hezbollah.
Right.
And then international humanitarian law also prohibits indiscriminate attacks because you have to prevent the risk to others who are nearby. And here you've got people driving in cars when the explosion goes off, standing in crowds, and, you know, shopping and so on, potentially on an airplane, you don't know, or a gas station or something. So these are indiscriminate attacks by their very nature. And then the other thing that I haven't heard others talk about is that booby traps are generally prohibited in international humanitarian law because of the risk that they pose to civilians.
Right.
So in international humanitarian law, when they talk about booby traps, the ones that are prohibited are, and I'm quoting, you know, things that are designed to look like harmless portable objects, something you can carry around with you, right? Clearly pagers and phones and those sort of things would count, or something that is disguised as something that would be attractive to civilians. So no matter how you look at that, these kinds of booby traps are prohibited by international humanitarian law. And even booby traps that didn't have those qualities, they're still subject to the general rules on the conduct of hostilities. So let's say that, you know, some of these things were provided to combatants amongst the Hezbollah personnel, and even if they didn't meet those, which they do, these were pagers. They were designed to look like harmless portable civilian objects, right? But even if they weren't, you see here a violation of the principle of distinction. You know, you have to be able to make sure that your attacks will affect combatants and not civilians who are nearby. Proportionality, the principle of precaution. these were just blind attacks. These were not attacks that took place when somebody was on the battlefield or was segregated or whatever. These, there was no precaution to avoid or minimize incidental loss of civilian life or injury to civilians, damage to civilian objects. All of those principles were violated by this massive terrorist attack that took place on Lebanon today. And I have said it will have to be followed by accountability. And interestingly, we've had, you know, decades of the entire Western world talking about the importance of international cooperation to respond to terrorist attacks. Let's see how much international cooperation follows this massive terrorist attack from the governments of the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, and others in the West. I won't be holding my breath.
I want to know, you know, you said there has to be accountability, but will there be accountability? And what is the effect of the lack of accountability? I mean, when the West does nothing about this, which I assume they won't, how does this embolden Israel? And what do you think it would look like, a world in which Israel were held to account? How much less terrorism and violence would we see?
Well, you know, the central principle of international human rights and international humanitarian law is the idea that impunity cannot be allowed to stand because it encourages further violations.
Right.
That, you know, if a state or a non-state actor can get away with something without being held accountable under the law, they're more likely to do it again. And the problem with Israel is it's had 76 years of impunity because it's had a brick wall of impunity built around it by the United States, the United Kingdom, some other Western powers that prevent it from being held to account. Just this week, again, we see threats against the International Criminal Court, which is in principle preparing to issue arrest warrants for the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defense of Israel for crimes against humanity. We've seen attacks from Western governments against the International Court of Justice for its work and findings and the genocide trial against Israel. You've seen, you know, allegations, or not allegations, but revelations of Western intelligence agencies from the United States, from Israel and elsewhere, harassing, threatening, persecuting judicial personnel in the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. We've seen delays in justice in those cases, probably attributable to that kind of intimidation. So the U.S., the U.K., Germany, and some others in the West work very hard to ensure Israeli impunity. Not only is that likely to lead to more violations, not only has that led to a chain of continuous violations of international law by Israel over a period of decades, and not only is it likely to lead to more of these kinds of violations perpetrated by Israel, but it's also likely to lead to the use of these kinds of tactics by others. Because if it's okay for Israel to do it, it's okay for others to do it. If it's not a crime when Israel does it, it's not a crime when ISIS does it, for example. And so these kinds of things, if there isn't accountability, make us all less safe. I don't expect accountability to come from any Western countries or any Western-controlled institutions, which means the Security Council will be unable to act because of the U.S. veto, you know, undoubtedly. But let's hope that judicial institutions will be in a position, or perhaps more majoritarian institutions like the General Assembly or the Human Rights Council, to follow up on all of this. There's, you know, at the same time, Katie, there is a resolution which is being negotiated in the General Assembly as a follow-up to the most recent opinion of the International Court of Justice that found that Israel's occupation of the entire West Bank, Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem is entirely unlawful, that they have to leave, dismantle, and that all states have to cut off their trade, diplomatic, and economic relations with Israel to the extent that they relate to the occupied territories. And in the General Assembly right now, they're negotiating a resolution that will probably be adopted on Wednesday or so, tomorrow, maybe later. And part of what is in the current draft is the idea of establishing accountability mechanisms to make sure that Israel doesn't get away with the crimes that it's been perpetrating with impunity. You could see something similar for these kinds of actions. So you will remember from our previous conversations when the Security Council is blocked by the U.S. veto, then the General Assembly can act under Uniting for Peace, emergency special session, or in a regular session to adopt measures to try to hold Israel accountable. But I think people all around the world need to make their voices heard that this very dangerous rogue state, which just keeps upping the ante, including, you know, as relates to terror directed against the Palestinian indigenous people, to its neighbors, and, you know, through its proxies to all of us who dare to speak out. It's really important that everyone make their voice heard and say enough is enough. This can't continue.
I want to actually ask you, there's some critics in the chat, and sometimes we ignore them, but I actually think it can be useful to sometimes highlight their talking points, because I think they should be, you know, responded to and when appropriate, debunked. So someone in the chat wrote, show me someone, one person not connected in some way to Hezbollah who suffered injuries. And yes, the Iranian ambassador is a Hezbollah asset. So what are your responses to those arguments?
Well, first of all, we already heard from Rania that civilians who were close to the people who were targeted were also injured. We don't know the total death toll and injury toll. I've seen horrendous footage of people with all of their fingers blown off,
right,
holes in their abdomen, with all sorts of really grave wounds. Some of those are civilians as well. Secondly, whether you like the Iranian ambassador or whether he has a relationship with Hezbollah does not make him a target under international law. To the contrary, he is a protected person. And so that is a crime in targeting him as well. Also, you know, I understand that Israel and the United States have declared that Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. It's not a terrorist organization under international law. It hasn't been found to be a terrorist body in that respect. And even if you want to say that about combatants from Hezbollah, as I already pointed out, Hezbollah is also a political party and a part of the government in Lebanon. It also runs programs in Lebanon. So those people are civilians. Not the combatants are combatants, but the others are civilians. That's unlawful to attack them in this way,
right,
as well. So you don't have a like get out of jail free card just by saying we consider those people to be terrorists, so anyone associated with them can be killed. I will remind the person in the chat that there are people all over the world that consider Israel to be a terrorist entity.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that everyone associated, civilians, with terrorists is a legitimate target, including their defenders in the Western Zone. They are not. Israeli combatants are legitimate targets, but not civilians who are part of that society or who defend it or whatever. If we didn't have these rules, then we are all soldiers and we are all targets. And if you want to see what that kind of world looks like, then, you know, situate yourself in the middle of Europe in the early 1940s and see how that goes.
I'm sure he would not be okay with someone killing someone associated with the Israeli government or the Israeli army, the IDF, which obviously engages in terrorism. It's not a difficult thing to determine. We had Noor Erekat on, a human rights lawyer, and she pointed out that Israel and their defenders admit that they're engaging in terrorism because they say they'll do certain things or stop doing certain things if Hamas, you know, releases the prisoners, as if that justifies their assaults on civilians. I think it speaks to the entitlement and the way that double standards are just so embraced that no one actually thinks that what they're asking for and what they're defending would ever be done to the people that they like. Like this person is like talking about how it's, you know, it's someone's kid, it's the father's fault. Well, would it be the fault of an Israeli IDF member or Israeli politician if their kid were killed? I don't think this person would think that. Anyway,
I mean, that's the whole basis of the international legal framework, is that it's based upon humanity, right? It applies to everybody. These are the rules.
Right.
And if you want to be lawful, you follow these rules. If you want to be barbaric, right, then you just say it's my tribe and the hell with everybody else. Right. And, you know, we've seen this. I mean, it's amazing in social media, I have to say. You know, I have to, like, look away from social media, you know, X and others, because, you know, the horrific things that I will see where people are just defending horror. So, for example, I mean, to your point, you know, if I tweet something about a massive war crime perpetrated in Gaza on a given day, in my comments, I'll have a bunch of people say, well, then release the hostages.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Or, you know, you shouldn't mess around. So, in other words, they're saying it's okay that they're slaughtering civilians because this other thing has happened. What, you know, what kind of human beings?
Right.
Are these, and what kind of a world are they trying to create in which that's the way the rules work? And I think that's, you know, I've said this before, it's the Palestinians are on the front lines in all of this, and the Lebanese as well. But the entire international system and the safety of all of us is also on the line, and it's being sacrificed, over the course of the last 10, 11 months in ways that we hadn't seen it before, although there are periods in history where we have come close. And we all have a stake in this, all of us.
Right. Okay, one more thing I want to read you, just because I want you to respond to it. So one of the people killed apparently was a 9-year-old girl whose father was in Hezbollah. So one of our haters says in the comments, her father put his entire family in danger because of his hatred of Jews, which again, that's embracing terrorism, right? Like the literal logic of terrorism. There's no rule of law. There's no respect for international humanitarian law. And here is apparently the little girl, the 9-year-old, Fatima Jafar Abdullah, 9 years old. So that's her.
Well, that's so absurd on so many levels. I mean, first of all, if you're not a human being, you can't look at that kid and think that shouldn't have happened. Secondly, Hezbollah is not an organization that exists out of hatred of Jews. I mean, that little rhetorical device used to justify every kind of atrocity, you would think that by now the people who use it would realize it doesn't work on anyone. People are more sophisticated. They know that Hezbollah is not an organization that is dedicated to hatred of Jews. Secondly, that Israel does not represent the Jewish people, as we've said so many times in our conversations. So that's utter nonsense. And then the other thing is that it was entirely foreseeable that if you just willy-nilly put bombs in people's personal devices, that their children, their spouses, perfect strangers who they're standing next to are also going to be harmed. And Israel is accountable for those harms because it violated the principle of distinction and the principle of precaution under international humanitarian law. If there's some ghoul out there that is taking joy out of the death of that little girl based upon some kind of racist idea, then I can't, I really can't help them. But as a matter of international law, that's evidence of a crime. It's not evidence of some tribal justice.
Yeah, it's really insane how people like think that these rationalizations are anything but bigotry and ignorance. They have delusions. I don't even know if they have delusions of it. They either really believe it, or they know that they're lying, or they're trying to convince themselves that they have like some kind of legal justification on their side. But and you are here to disabuse them of that, of course. Before we get to your article about how Israel does not have the right to self-defense, I want to ask you about another article that you wrote at Foreign Policy in Focus.
Oh, okay.
It is called WGOG, the UN Settler Colonial Bloc, a UN grouping anchored by the Anglo countries, Israel, and European states wields disproportionate power to undermine human rights and international law. So tell us about this article and how it relates to the very discussion that we're having.
Well, the connection here, obviously. So this is a diplomatic grouping in the UN called WEOG, W-E-O-G. And the UN organizes itself, the delegations, the countries organize themselves in so-called regional groupings. There's five of them. Four of those regional groupings are regions. There's like Asia Pacific, Africa, Latin America, Eastern Europe. And then the fifth group is the only one that's not organized according to a region. And it's the WEOG, Western Europe and Other Group. Well, Western Europe is obvious, but in my article, I explained that the other group part is something very, very interesting. And what it represents is countries that are not in Europe, but were states that were founded by European settler colonialism. And you can list them, It's the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Israel. And during apartheid, it also included South Africa, right? Which sort of gives away the game. So while the others are all regional, represent regions, this group, which is Western Europe and other group, represents essentially the white world. And that I point out in the article is very shocking to the casual reader. But for people who follow the study of international relations, it's not shocking because the West has always centered its approach to international relations on race, so much so that international relations as an area of study used to be called race relations. And Foreign Affairs, which is the leading U.S. publication on international relations, was originally called the Journal of Race Development. And it always put whiteness at the center and at the top. And others were somewhere down below. And so you still have this vestige of this white supremacist colonial approach to international relations that is, you know, solidified in the current structures at the UN as a result of that. And you can see it in the way that they vote. So first of all, they have disproportionate power. So it's not democratic, because these countries and this group actually has more power compared to its size than the Africans, the Asians, the Latin Americans, and otherwise. Now, they always try to defend themselves or to build themselves as being a group of Western democracies, but that's always been a lie, because you know they've had throughout their lifetime they've had a lot of non-democratic countries. When Spain and Portugal and Greece, their founding members of this group, they were governed by dictatorships until the mid-1970s. South Africa and Israel were both admitted as apartheid countries. And the U.S., of course, until the mid-1960s, had Jim Crow, had a system of racial segregation, so not really a democracy. And they're not all Western, because some of them are in the South Pacific, some of them are in the Middle East, some of them are in Africa, so they can't call themselves Western democracies. Other times they've tried to say, well, we're kind of like the anti-Soviet bloc or the anti-communist bloc, but that's not true, because there are lots of countries around the world that were anti-communist, anti-Soviet, but were never allowed to be members of the WEOG. And so it's my effort to pull back the curtain and show that you have this group that has disproportionate power, that's based upon the vestiges of white supremacy and colonialism, and its voting in the UN does a lot of harm to the cause of human rights. This is where you see real opposition to the UN's anti-racism work. It's where you see real opposition to the UN's work on indigenous peoples' rights, the rights of indigenous peoples, the right to development, especially in poorer countries. And obviously, it is the main line preventing self-determination and the full realization of human rights by the Palestinian people, because this is the bloc, the only part of the world that hasn't recognized the state of Palestine, first of all, many of them, and secondly, that blocks voting to provide them with protections for the human rights of the Palestinian people. And, you know, it's just something that was kind of stuck in my craw when I was at the UN. And I realized nobody has ever written about this, as far as I can see. So I thought it was time to tell the story.
Yeah, well, thank you for doing that. Let's go back to your article about how Israel does not actually have the right to self-defense. And you call this a double lie. So can you walk us through your very important article?
Yeah, so I mean, I felt this was really necessary because how many times have people who have followed what's happening in the Middle East heard this phrase, "We believe Israel has a right to defend itself." And that is usually a phrase which is delivered by Western politicians and spokespersons or, you know, government adjacent corporate media companies after Israel commits some massive war crime. So there'll be a massive slaughter, and then these people will be asked about it, and the first thing they'll say is, well, Israel has a right to defend itself. I thought it was really important to unpack that, what I called the self-defense canard, because Israel does not have a right to defend itself in that way. As a matter of international law, as you said, this is a double lie. First, Israel does not have an Article 51 right to self-defense in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, or in the Golan Heights. And then secondly, the acts that they are trying to justify by saying that Israel has a right to self-defense are not justifiable under international law. So even if self-defense applied, those acts would still be crimes. So it's a double lie in that sense. And this is based upon, clearly based upon international law. The UN Charter says that they have to respect self-determination, human rights, they have to refrain from the use of force, and so on. Those are violations when Israel breaches those principles. And there is a temporary exception to the prohibition on the use of force in the UN Charter. That's where Article 51 is. But that's for self-defense from external attacks, like by other states. And specifically in international law, you do not have that right of self-defense if the threat emanates from inside territory that you control, including occupied territory. And that was explicitly affirmed by the World Court in its 2004 opinion on Israel's apartheid wall. So this is not editorializing. This is something which is very clear in international law. And then again, in this 2024 opinion on the occupation, they confirmed again, Israel is the occupying power across all of Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. So it can't claim self-defense as a justification for making war, for launching military attacks on Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, or the Golan Heights. Its principal obligation in those territories is its job under international law. It has to protect the occupied population. So this would be inconsistent, you know, if they use that. And even, you know, normally the power that they would have in those occupied territories as the occupying power would be law enforcement functions, right, as distinct from military operations. But even that is now questionable because the World Court has found that the occupation itself is entirely unlawful. So even the powers that derive from humanitarian law for occupying powers would likely be illegitimate here, which leaves them with the only redress they have. If they think there's a threat that's emanating from Gaza or the West Bank or any occupied territories, their redress for that is to leave, to remove the threat by removing themselves from those places. Now, Israel, you know, Israel can repel attacks from within its own territory, although that's a much more complicated argument because if they're using the language of repelling attacks in order to launch attacks on the occupied territories, they're in breach again. But they cannot make war on the occupied territories as they've been doing. So they don't have that right to self-defense. Now, the other piece of this, Katie, I point out in the article is that, well, Israel does not have that right to self-defense to make war on the occupied territories. Palestinian people under international law do have a right, do have that right. Yeah. Palestinians have a right to use armed force under international law.
Against combatants, as opposed to civilians.
This, again, is rooted in the Charter, international humanitarian human rights law, a series of very explicit United Nations resolutions that say that Palestinian resistance groups have a legal right to armed resistance to free the Palestinian people from, and I'm quoting, foreign occupation, colonial domination, and apartheid. The whole world agrees to this. I mean, obviously not we all, but the majority of the world, the GA, the UN, that the inalienable right of the Palestinian people and all people under foreign occupation, colonial domination, and so on, it means that there is the legitimacy of the struggle of these peoples can be, you know, carried out by all available means, including armed struggle. Now, of course, in carrying out the resistance struggle, they have to respect the rules of humanitarian law, including the principle of distinction to spare civilians, no question about it. But their right to fight is beyond doubt. And the other interesting piece here that we've been talking about is I point out that since the Palestinian people have a recognized legal right to resist occupation, apartheid, and genocide, including through armed struggle, since that underlying right is there and their resistance is lawful, that also means that any alliances, aid, and support that goes to Palestinian resistance groups for that purpose are also lawful. While Israel's occupation, apartheid, and genocide are unlawful under international law, and the court has found this to be true, which means that any support to Israel by Western states for those endeavors is unlawful. So the way that the story is told in Western media and by Western politicians is completely upside down. And in fact, the World Court has found that all states are obliged to end any support to Israel for what it's doing in the occupied territories, and they're obliged to end to work to end Israel's occupation. And then the last thing I said here, Katie, is that, well, and I also, as I mentioned before, you know, even if they had the right to self-defense, the acts that they're trying to justify with arguments of self-defense are not justified by self-defense. They would still be crimes, right? So I think politicians have to be called out for that. And then the other thing is, you know, the very idea of self-defense means that you hit me first, and so I get to hit you back. And I, you know, pointed out that in the 1930s and 40s, you didn't have Palestinians traveling to Europe to attack Zionist colonists in their homes in Europe. What you had is Zionist colonists traveling from Europe to come and attack Palestinians in their homes in Palestine. So, you know, who threw the first punch? It's very clear historically who threw the first punch in that case. And that since that time, you've had just an absolutely brutalized indigenous Palestinian people, ethnic cleansing, genocide, you know, all of the horrors that we've been witnessing for all of this time. And every peaceful effort by the Palestinians to end that oppression, diplomatic initiatives, judicial initiatives, peaceful protest, organized boycotts and divestment, all of that has been met by repression or rejection by Israel and by its Western allies. So I finished just by saying that just basic morality and simple logic dictate that the Palestinians have a right to self-defense. Their oppressor does not. And that is the position as well of international law.
So like on October 7th, for instance, they have the right, it's legally under IHL, they have the right to attack soldiers, active members of the IDF, right? Not obviously civilians. So people who have served in the army, once they are no longer in the army, they are now once again in the civilian population. Is that correct? It's not like once you've been in the IDF, you're for your entire life a combatant?
Okay. No. So there's a principle of hors combat. So it's just combatants, active combatants. Active, right. The same thing goes for the Palestinians as well. You can't say, well, that guy used to be with Hamas, and so you can just take a shot at him. Yeah.
Now, what is the way that Israel could have or should have? I mean, it's a little weird because their whole occupation is illegal, but how could they have responded to the... not the armed resistance against combatants, but the killing of civilians that happened on October 7th. And I want to say we don't know how many were killed by Israel versus by people, Palestinians on October 7th. We don't know how many of them were official members of Hamas versus just people who broke through. What is the legally acceptable way in IHL to respond to killing of civilians that happened on October 7th?
Well, these are those, you know, where crimes are committed, where war crimes are committed. The answer to that is not to respond with war crimes. The answer is to respond with the rule of law. And, you know, so first of all, you know, those things that Hamas did that were legitimate, like breaking out of the Gaza prison, like engaging Israeli troops, like overcoming Israeli military posts, like taking prisoners of war, all of that under international law is legitimate. And Israel has no recourse for that. Israel is guilty of the equivalent of aggression with its occupation, colonization of Palestine. When it comes to the attacks on war crimes, you know, attacks on civilians or the taking of civilian hostages, you know, if Israel after October 7th had decided that it was going to pursue accountability for those people who perpetrated war crimes on that day, by the way, including Israelis who killed a lot of civilians on that day, but also fighters from Gaza who violated the laws of war by killing civilians or taking civilian hostages. It would have had the cooperation of the entire world in pursuing perpetrators in judicial processes and so on. It chose not to do that. It chose to expedite its genocide on the Palestinian people as its response. So, and it could have used its military forces on its territory to defend civilians and civilian infrastructure. You know, all of that is possible. But the minute it decided to go to war in Gaza, it exceeded its rights under international humanitarian law.
Just want to quickly highlight some comments. So thank you, Susan Stone, for always being so generous and supportive, and also want to read her comment. This Israel techno-terror is incredibly scary. Israel sells their techno-terror technology to anyone willing to buy. When will our police forces use this on us? Not in my name, not with my tax dollars.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, very powerful statement.
That stuff's not going to go away.
Yeah.
Now that it's out of the bottle, you know.
Right. I don't want to engage every person who comments, but one person, I think it's a great example of how ridiculous and disingenuous some of these arguments are. So one person said, no one in Lebanon was dying before Hezbollah began a war of aggression against Israel. That's just an ineluctable fact, which is hilarious because not only were people dying in Lebanon before Hezbollah even existed, Israel during its 1982 invasion was so brutal and killed so many people that Ronald Reagan picked up the phone, called Menachem Begin, told him to stop what he was doing, and called it a Holocaust.
Yeah.
Reagan, not exactly a proud anti-Zionist. So
yeah, and ordered the Israelis to stop. But I mean, that commentator has it exactly upside down. Hezbollah was founded to repel attacks from Israel, so no one was being killed on either side of that that border until. And by the way, you know, people have to remember that Lebanon was also suffered from a brutal occupation by Israeli occupation forces. More than once, not to mention the invasions and the attacks on all the way up to Beirut and beyond by Israeli forces, and that the only deterrent that they have enjoyed is Hezbollah to those kinds of attacks that Lebanese civilians have suffered from for so long and continue to suffer from. Right up until today.
Yeah, we actually had a fascinating guest on Useful Idiots. I'd love to have her on this show. She's in Lebanon, though, so it's hard with the time difference. Ghadi Francis is her name, and she's Christian. I mean, she's fairly secular, but she's Christian by background. She's not Muslim. She finds Hezbollah's, you know, ideology. She doesn't share their ideology, but she says she's incredibly grateful to them because she feels that they keep people safe. I mean, again, and she's kind of like, and their ideology is great. It makes them really brave fighters because of what they believe. It's not what she has, what she believes in. But again, it's a fascinating discussion and one that you can't ever have in the Western media, where the vilification of people like Hezbollah and Hamas is just, there's no conversation to be had about it. They are just villain, full stop. That's how the media presents them, which would be one thing if they were presenting Israel as terrorists, which they don't. So all of these labels that get thrown around as if they actually mean anything and aren't just weapons of prejudice are quite interesting.
Well, that's very much by design, too, because this whole thing of, because if you want to move an entity that is your adversary outside the bounds of international law, you simply declare that they're a terrorist and then anything
exactly,
goes at that moment. But that's not how international law works. It is how the United States works. It is how Israel works. It is how other Western countries
And we talked about this last week, how the...
Not just Western countries, by the way, lots of countries.
And we talked about this last week about how the lies about the mass rape, and again, we've both been clear on this, there may have been individual rapes, we don't know, but there was not a mass campaign of rape. And we do know that there is a systemic campaign of rape committed by the Israelis. And we know that from various sources, tons of Palestinian sources, but also Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization. But we talked about this last week, how part of the reason that the rape narrative is so important for Zionists and defenders of Zionism, or Jewish supremacy, as Norman Finkelstein calls it, it's so important because it dehumanizes them. So once you say these people are all terrorists, or once you say these people are all rapists, then you don't have to give them any rights, because even though that's not what international humanitarian law says, and that's why atrocity propaganda is so important, because it just gets people to skip any rational analysis of things like human rights law. So
it dehumanizes and it makes it easier then to carry out whatever atrocities you want to carry out. And we talked about last week about this idea of accusation in the mirror, and that the rape stuff is a perfect example of that.
You've been so generous with your time. Any final words?
Nothing I can think of. Always nice to be with you, Katie.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Craig. And everyone should follow Craig on Twitter. Okay. Have a great night, Craig. Guys, this has been an amazing show. I'm so grateful to everyone for coming. I'm so grateful to everyone who watched the show. Thank you so much, Rania Kalik. Thank you so much, Craig McIver. Thank you, Brad, Fantomas Fanta, Tyler, Nate. And if you bought tickets to the show on Thursday, you're in luck. We'll see you there. And again, if you want to see our interview with none other than Jeremy Corbyn, then please become Patreon members at patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. I think that's all. I'll see you guys next week. Bye, everyone.